So, you want to be a poker pro. In a world of big data-powered GTO or game theory optimal, the dream of becoming a poker pro might be as good as dead. That is just one of the insights we gleaned from our guest this week, Ben Saxton. Ben is a New Orleans-based writer, teacher, and serious poker player who works as a poker journalist and is also well into a book project about Gulf Coast poker players. He's going to talk to us this week about all things poker, particularly in the context of Labrotis' conquest of poker pros and the role of AI and big data-driven poker engines in the game today. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My co-host is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 6 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. Speaking with Christopher Chabria in Episode 4 earlier this season, we explored the myriad ways that Deep Blue's victory specifically and the evolution of chess engines over the last 22 years in general have changed not only how people play and learn chess, but also how they perceive machine play and the roles machines have in the game. Machine chess, once a criticism meaning foolishly unorthodox play, has become a compliment. It is machines that the world's best players use to improve their game. On our last episode, Noam Brown explained that, similarly in poker, machines are not only defeating top poker pros, but are doing so in unorthodox and creative ways. Their machine learning completely ignores the opponent, invalidating tried and true tactics such as looking for tells and getting to know the player. Instead, the machine is defeating poker pros the same way it defeats the best in perfect information games like chess, finding the best move from a huge range of possible choices and ruthlessly applying it over and over and over. But poker is a very different game than chess or Go. At a superficial level, poker is more casual, social, and approachable. Gambling is inextricably wound into poker, bringing professional gamblers on one extreme and casual dreamers on the other into the game in significant numbers. It is also a popular home game, where friends and foes alike get together at someone's house or online poker lobby for regular play. Poker can make a good case for being America's game, with similar popularity in many other parts of the world. So, what impact are AI and big data having in poker? Our guest Ben Saxton is going to give us an inside look. Ben is involved at every level of the game, as a journalist reporting on the highest levels of pro play, as an author deeply exploring everyday professional play in his home of New Orleans, and as a serious recreational player, in my mind a semi-professional, a term Ben humbly shies away from.
So I'm a teacher and a writer based in New Orleans, and I teach literature and writing classes. I have a background in humanities, went to school to study American literature, and as far as poker, I've been writing about poker for the last 4 or 5 years, I would say. And my interest in poker, I guess I would say I'm interested both in poker and the poker world more broadly. What appeals to me most, I would say, are the people, the stories. So New Orleans is a great place for me to be based. I would consider myself a serious recreational player, I guess. I've been playing for probably about 15 years, and I came up with a lot of others on the heels of the poker boom and Chris Moneymaker, and got my start primarily online. Something called Black Friday happened in 2011 that sidelined me and many others. But mostly I kind of circled back to poker and mainly the live scene around 2014. And that's really where I spend most of my time. I play in a lot of different games here in New Orleans. I go out to the World Series of Poker in Las Vegas and mainly do writing and reporting out there, but I play a bit as well.
Despite AlphaGo's recent conquest against top professional Lee Sedol, the poker world was surprised by Labrotis' superiority.
I think it was probably a little bit humbling for the players. They were taken a little bit by surprise, especially how they did given 2 years earlier against Claudico. Labrotis apparently was much improved from its predecessor. But I think more generally, it kind of reaffirmed the school of poker pros who advocate, you know, the so-called GTO or game theoretically optimal approach. So I think in a lot of ways, it just reaffirmed their grounding in a GTO style. And, you know, it's one thing for a computer to take down a strong player, to take down an elite player. It's another thing for Labrotis to beat convincingly four of the best heads up, no limit Texas Hold'em players in the world. And that's what happened. So I don't think it was necessarily even a disappointing thing. I think it might have been initially a bit surprising and humbling, but in the end, I think it reaffirmed those who believe strongly in a so-called GTO approach.
GTO is an acronym for Game Theory Optimal, a more recent and increasingly dominant approach to poker. Let's get a better understanding of some of the philosophies and terms.
The best way that I like to think about it is starting not with poker, but with rock, paper, scissors, which is a simplified game that shares a lot of qualities with poker. And, so just imagine that you're playing rock, paper, scissors, and you're condemned to play the very best rock, paper, scissors player in the world. So your best bet is to play a game theory optimal strategy. And the Nash equilibrium strategy for rock, paper, scissors is both known and it's applicable. So you want to throw, it's a mixed strategy. So you want to throw rock one third of the time, paper one third of the time, and scissors one third of the time. And there's nothing that this incredible rock, paper, scissors player can do to exploit you. You're unexploitable. Now the downside to this approach is that you can't exploit this player. So just imagine for a moment another extreme. You're playing your buddy. Maybe he's a geologist and he really likes rocks. So he throws rock 100% of the time. Now, if you were playing a GTO style, that wouldn't be nearly as effective as a so-called exploitative approach, which would be simply to throw paper. Because paper beats rock. So you would make way more money and you would crush your geologist friend by employing a so-called exploitative approach. And so to kind of transition back to poker, thinking about, like, if I were to describe GTO poker in a word, it would probably be balance. I think Libratus actually, it might translate into, it might be Latin for balance. And what that means essentially is in every situation, in every betting range that Libratus is constructing, you always will have a mix of strong hands and weak hands, or value bets and bluffs. And those terms are kind of problematic because hand values are dynamic. They're always changing based on different cards that come out. But in general, Libratus is extremely balanced. Anyone who is playing a near optimal style is going to always have a mixture of strong hands and weak hands. So poker, like rock, paper, scissors, involves a mixed strategy. Now, to kind of round out the example, imagine you're at your local casino playing 1-2 no limit Texas Hold'em with 9 other people. And you're there for about an hour and you're playing against a guy across the table who's about 70, and he has folded every hand that he has played preflop for the last hour. And he's reading his paper and he's intermittently napping. And suddenly he's dealt a hand and he raises to $20, which is some huge amount. Now you happen to be dealt pocket jacks, pocket queens, pocket kings. What do you do here? So this is a situation where we often find ourselves in very low stakes games playing against opponents who have very transparent, unbalanced styles. This guy is not, quote unquote, balancing his range. He probably has a very strong hand. And for those players who are, this is kind of the critique of the GTO approach within the poker community, the logic kind of goes, hey, we're not playing supercomputers. We're playing people who are really transparent, and we can burn a lot of money by, re-raising this guy with ace five suited because it's a good bluffing hand, or re-raising this guy with pocket jacks or pocket queens or whatever it might be. So this GTO versus exploitative debate, it's taken shape in a couple different ways. One individual who listeners might be familiar with, who falls firmly on the exploitative, or the his preferred term is the white magic side, is Phil Hellmuth. who has won a lot of WSOP bracelets. He's undeniably accomplished a lot of things, and he is kind of adamantly opposed to, you know, the so-called GTO approach. Somebody who I think is an interesting example, he's kind of gravitated to and he's embraced some of the more systematic approaches involving GTO is Daniel Negreanu. So he's somebody who has long been associated with kind of live reads, the intangibles, just kind of feeling his way through a hand. And in recent years, he went back into the lab, so to speak, and he really worked hard. I think he may have hired or worked with some very talented younger online players. And so he's somebody who is trying to kind of weave together these two approaches. But I think that this is the central debate. It's like, to what extent do players want to be playing in an optimal manner? Do they want to be balanced? Do they want to have a mix of strong hands and weak hands? And to what extent should they be deviating from equilibrium strategy and just flat out exploiting really transparent opponents?
We learned from Labrada's co-creator Noam Brown that Labrada's training ignored this exploitative style in its training, but did implicitly use it when interactively reflecting on its play against the human pros from one session to the next. Labrada's essentially validated the GTO approach as optimal for defeating top pros. That is not absolutely the case, however.
Yeah, I think a big part of it depends on who you're playing against and at what level. I don't think there's too much controversy about whether or not you want to be playing a GTO balanced strategy at the very highest limits. I think that if you're deviating too much from an optimal strategy, you're going to be playing against really savvy opponents who will exploit you, and you really want to avoid that. But where a lot of there's a lot of disagreement involves how poker is taught and studied. To the vast majority of us who are not going to be playing 25K high rollers, we're going to our local casinos. We're playing against, again, very very transparent opponents who we might hope to exploit. And so that's kind of the conversation. And I think it seems like a middle ground is desirable, having a kind of a firm sense of what equilibrium strategy looks like and then deviating from it when necessary. I think that is a potential middle ground that players can look for. But it's the center of much debate.
This is an important bit of nuance. Labrada's may in fact be better at optimizing its results against the very best players as opposed to worst players. As a player's skill goes down, an exploitative strategy that is reacting in the moment, something that Labrada's is incapable of in the ways Ben describes, is best. That gives us guidance for how machines will behave in other contexts, what their strengths and limitations will be. Let's take a broader look at how poker strategy has evolved over the years.
One place to start would be with a guy who I had the chance to interview last summer, a guy named Carl McKelvey, who is from Houston. He was one of the original participants in the first World Series of Poker. This is back in the 60s. He was a Texas road gambler, and I don't think too many listeners would be familiar with him, but they may have heard of Bobby Hoff, who is a Texas Hold'em legend, one of the very best players who ever lived. And so Carl and Bobby, they were traveling partners, and they went around. And I actually asked Carl, well, how did you guys improve? How did you study? And what he said was, there were no resources. We just talked to each other about what players were doing and how to beat them. So that was kind of the baseline level. And I think if you think about the access to information that these early players had, there was almost nothing to be had. So it was fascinating talking to Carl about those early days. And I think there are some early texts that came out. Doyle Brunson, his book Super System came out in 1979. And so there's been a gradual accumulation of knowledge in the poker community that really started to pick up steam during the poker boom. And I think that, you know, when you think in terms of access to information, a lot of the early strategy conversations happen on online message boards. So I think there was a website called rec.gambling that just a lot of savvy poker, you know, interested poker players went to talk strategy. 2+2 forums are still, they're not so much a hub for strategy talk anymore, but in those early years around 2005, that was a hub. And then I think it was 2005, 2006, online training sites started to pop up. So Card Runners was one of the first online training sites, and you could basically, it was subscription based. You could pay for a subscription and watch videos that, you know, a lot of it was just like one of the pros taping an online session and talking about how he played hands. And so in recent years, I think that there's been just a proliferation, and we've almost reached a saturation point in terms of how poker media is consumed. So the strategy heavy online training sites still do exist, and that is available. But what we've seen in like the last 2-3 years is something that I would call pokertainment, which is really a mixture of strategy talk, kind of light strategy talk, and then just entertaining videos. And this involves everything from like Twitch streams to vlogging has really blown up within the poker community. And I think if I were to point to one person who really embodies this, the pokertainment trend, it would be Doug Polk, who was at one point the best heads up no limit Texas Hold'em player in the world. He played against Claudico in 2015, and he just started releasing free YouTube videos. There, some of them are just pure entertainment, but then he also has like a poker hands segment in which he would just show a hand and talk his way through it. And so, even indirectly, a lot of folks are at the table. They're on their tablets. They're on their iPads. Whatever. Just watching a Doug Polk video, they're indirectly gaining some kind of strategy sense. And you know, I think we're going to see that trend continue. It's not going anywhere. So I think that we're at almost a saturation point in terms of the content that's out to be consumed. And you know, when you mention artificial intelligence, there are a few software programs. So one example that comes to mind is Poker Snowy. That's a neural network, and you can actually, again, it's subscription based. You can go to the website and you can play against Poker Snowy in real time, and it's a great way to get an experiential sense of you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about, well, what does GTO play look like and feel like, and if you can play against Snowy, which, you know, all of these artificial intelligence programs, you know, they're all kind of near optimal or pseudo GTO, whatever you want to call them. So you can now go online and play against Poker Snowy. So we're at a point where you just think about where someone like Carl McKelvey was 30, 40 years ago to where we are now. It really is a world of difference.
The evolution of poker strategy and technology generally mirrors that of the internet and connected technologies. From analog to online to phone and video, now to big data-driven complex engines that put the supercomputer into the palms of our hand. Ben's going to take a deep dive into how these poker engines work, after which I will give a more simple explanation for the non-poker players among us.
I have spent a few hours here and there kind of fumbling through a few of the solvers. So to the difference between Poker Snowy and there are a few quote-unquote solvers that are out there called Pio Solver, GTO Plus, and what they do essentially is they offer users a game theory optimal solution of simplified parts of poker. So these solvers aren't offering an optimal solution about poker in general, but they're simplified parts of the game. They're so-called toy games. I think the best way might be just to offer an example of, like, you load one of these programs up and you have to input a couple variables that work as constraints. So the first constraint is that, like rock, paper, scissors, these solvers, they deal only in heads up situations. So there is one solver called, I think it's called Munker Solver, that deals with multi-way spots. But the first constraint is these are heads-up situations, and say you want to think about one particular spot in no limit hold'em. So you input a range of hands. Let's say you input 20% range of hands. So that might include hands like pocket threes, queen nine, king jack, pocket aces. So you input one range of hands, one distribution, and then you input a second range of hands for the in position player. So there's just two positions, out of position and in position. And then you input a couple other variables like what's the starting pot? What are the effective stacks? Like how much money can be bet? Bet sizing is a huge difference between solving limit hold'em poker and no limit hold'em poker. So I think limit hold'em was solved a few years back. No limit hold'em is incredibly complex in part because there's all these different bet sizes. So you input a couple bet sizing constraints. Then you run the solver, and what happens is the solver will, you can toggle between the out of position player's strategy and the in position player strategy. So you input the ranges, you input the stack sizes, and then you have to assign a flop. So let's just say you want the board to be ace of hearts, eight of clubs, four of clubs. So after you run the simulation, the solver will actually offer you an optimal range of hands to play. So you know, just imagine a grid with all the different starting hands. So you have pocket aces, you have ace nine offsuit, you have 6-2 offsuit, and it's all color coded. So the black part of the grid are the hands that you already folded, and then the hands that are in your range. So say you inputted the 20% range of hands. You know, it's color coded, so you have options of betting or checking a hand like pocket fives, betting or checking a hand like pocket eights. What about 10-9 suited? And if you hover over one of the hand rankings in the grid, you know, you'll remember that optimal poker involves something called mixed strategies. So there's all these different recommendations, call them, for how to play. Not just a hand, not just 10-9, because 10-9 is not a hand, but all 16 combinations of 10-9. So 10 of clubs, 9 of clubs, 10 of clubs, 9 of diamonds. And so you can actually hone in on every specific combination that is within your range and see what the solver actually does with it. So it spits out all this information, and you can tweak, you can assign different flops. You can move back and forth between the out of position player and the in position player. So if the out of position player decides to check, then you can look at how the in position player responds, and that you go back to the grid. You look at what hands in position player bets and checks. You can move through the hand. You can assign a fourth card, the turn. You can assign a fifth card, the river. So, it's just kind of a massive amount of information that players have to deal with and work with, and you know, it's kind of daunting at first glance. I think it takes a lot of working through, but in general, these solvers offer recommendations. They offer game theory optimal solutions for different parts of the game tree, different toy games that players can work through.
These engines allow players to enter in highly specific situations that they may find themselves in at the poker table and learn what the mathematical optimal way to play the situation is. What you need to know, however, is the number of specific positions a poker player could find themselves in begins to approach infinity. There could be anywhere between 2 and 10 players. The specific order you are seated in, and thus acting in, matters, so the card situations differ completely in, for instance, a 10-player game for each of the 10 possible spots. Of the 52-card deck, you have 2 cards, 1,326 combinations, and then separately there are 19,600 different flops, or first 3 face-up community cards, all of which is followed by 47 possible turn cards and 46 possible river cards. Added up, and the volume of results are staggering. So how exactly is the ability to study just one of these almost infinite situations useful to poker players?
I think that's one criticism, perhaps, of teaching GTO-style poker or expecting people to use solvers is just the it perhaps is diminishing returns, and it might even be counterproductive for someone who is not versed in how to actually use the software. So, you know, you mentioned how do pros use the software? I mean, a couple things come to mind. You know, one is that it allows them to develop a kind of intuition or unconscious competence. So, you know, when you're in a hand, the you're never going to be able to process what these solvers are offering up to you. So, you know, one thing that dedicated pros do, they just spend hours and hours and hours inputting ranges, inputting different flops, and seeing how a range interacts with another range. So just for example, you know, you put in a 20% range versus a 10% range. The flop comes ace, eight, four. How are you going to play all your hands in each range? What if the flop is jack, deuce, deuce? What if the flop is 8-7-6, all hearts? On top of that, what are the bet sizes that are being used to, you know, one of the things that probably the most important thing that poker players care about is expected value. How can they maximize the expected value of their range? So by actually going through and painstakingly over and over all these different possibilities, dedicated players, they're able to actually gain a sense of unconscious competence so that when they're at the table, they just act and they have a sense of what equilibrium strategy looks like, and they can kind of move on from there. But yeah, I think it's definitely a huge challenge, and it gets back to the question of what's the best way to teach poker. Is the best way to introduce a novice to PioSolver? I'm not sure. But if you have a novice who has evolved into an intermediate player who wants to actually compete at the highest level, then at some point, you know, they might want to explore the software.
The automation is really only for advanced users. It is a tool that enables the most serious and dedicated human players to, through repetition and expert knowledge, slowly layer this machine-validated optimal knowledge onto their play. So while it's a tool that technically anyone could use, it probably isn't smart for everyone to use it. Old-school, low-fidelity tools such as the ubiquitous video training is a better investment of training time for most players. The popularity of poker in the 2000s was fueled by online poker. What impact will engines and AI have on the online scene?
One is just that the games are tougher. And I think back in 2005, 2006, if you were a committed player and your goal was to build a bankroll from the micro stakes all the way up to the nosebleed games, that was something that, you know, a lot of players were able to do. Doug Polk is one example that he was playing 1 cent, 2 cent stakes online, and he went literally all the way to the top to becoming the best heads up Nolan Holdem player. Is that possible today? It's probably possible, but the games now apparently are just incredibly difficult. And you know, Doug Polk, for example, has even said the gap between the 2012 version of himself or the 2014 version of himself and the current best pros is actually pretty wide. And I think one reason for that is because of solvers. And, you know, one of the things that they have offered these really hardworking, smart, savvy players is a depth of precision that just did not exist beforehand. You know, if you're able to actually, you know, work through and interpret the different hands that these solvers are using in all these different spots, and you're able to craft these strategies, you're going to be very, very tough to beat. So I think the first worry, I suppose you could call it, would just be like, can I beat the games anymore? And I think the second point would probably relate to more like the integrity of the games. So my understanding is at the moment there are not, so the solvers take a long time to run these sims, right? They might take hours and hours. So it's not like you can actually like plug a situation into the solver, get a response when you're actually playing online. you know, there's a huge gap between the kinds of advice solvers are giving, and you can't actually respond in game. But apparently that may be a possibility down the road, and that may even exist now, so-called in-game solvers that can somehow give you advice about how to play optimally. And whether or not that exists now, I don't know. But, you know, just imagine a player who has software that can tell him how to play near to GTO style in game. How do you beat that player? A related issue would be poker bots. You have bots, they do exist, and they are able to beat the games, I believe, up to like mid stakes online. And in order to beat mid stakes online cash games, you need to be good. And there are bots that are currently beating those games. And so the security and the integrity of poker sites is kind of at stake here. So one of the questions about the online climate is just like, will AI overrun the online scene? Like, and the other thing is just from a marketing perspective, a lot of these sites rely on recreational players. It's not the pros who are making, who are going to keep these games live. It's the recreational players. So, I mean, what incentive do I have as a recreational player to go on PokerStars if I know that there's going to be, you know, really, really tough opponents, possibly bots? There's no clear answer. So I think there is some uncertainty about the direction that the online landscape is headed down the road. I think you'd probably get a range of responses depending on who you're talking to, but there's definitely some cause for concern.
Ben is also an educator, so his perspective on reciprocal lessons between poker and formal education are interesting.
So I thought about this question kind of from both ends, like what might poker players take away, and how might they learn better? And then also like what from poker do I take into the classroom? So for me, it's always kind of a reciprocal thing. But I think to answer your question, humility might be the first thing that comes to mind. There's a tendency to want to jump to kind of impose certainty on different situations. And I think one of the sobering necessary things we have to do, whether it's just thinking about poker in general or thinking about the impact of AI on poker, is what do we do with all this complexity, right? I mean, I can barely explain what a solver does, let alone how to interpret it. One of the things that I think Libratus did, for example, is it just opened everyone's eyes to how much is left to be done and how much better people can get or how powerful AI can get, just in the context of poker. So what do we do with that information? And how do we also kind of navigate through all that uncertainty? So I think having a kind of robust humility, just kind of appreciating the complexity while also trying to navigate through it, it seems important in poker, because it's so easy to just, want to impose some kind of certainty or closure just for our own peace of mind. We see this all the time someone was just talking to me yesterday about bad beat stories. Why do we tell bad beat stories? You know, well, we want to convince ourselves that we didn't make a mistake, right? And I think finding ways to both like accept our mistakes and grow from them is important, both in poker and elsewhere. One of the things about poker that's so challenging is how many unknowns there are. We don't know what we don't know a lot of times in poker. There are sometimes these eye-opening moments that happen courtesy of, apparently Libratus was doing things that the community collectively thought was non-standard or bad, and certain conventional wisdom that the community shared a couple years ago has been tossed on its head. And, you know, I think that's just a very important principle to bring into the classroom. You know, we all come into the classroom with our own assumptions about the world and the way the world works. And, you know, I'm somebody who, you know, I teach literature and writing classes. And, you know, for me, you know, the best way that I know to to help not just my students, but myself see more clearly or see in a different way is through fiction and short stories and novels, because you know, they allow us to imaginatively project ourselves into some other person, some other world, and see in a radically different way. So I think poker, there's so much capacity for deception and self-deception that it's a kind of a constant process of working through various delusions, you know, about our own skill, about other players who we think are strong players or weak players or whatever it might be, about different strategies that we once thought were effective that now aren't as effective. So one thing that poker has taught me is just to try to keep kind of growing outside my own perception and keep trying to see the world from a different angle.
And as we prepare to leave gaming behind and spend our next episodes of Creative Next on formal education, what are the interesting things Ben is seeing in that realm both today and tomorrow?
So, you know, I think for me, this is less a concrete advance or technology than an environment. I think that the most successful classrooms that I've been a part of are collaborative and dialogic. So I think it's very tempting, especially as an instructor, to go into the classroom and impose my authority, or present my own view as somehow being kind of the final word. And that's something that I fight against in the classroom. That's something that I really kind of work against. And I think one way to model dialogue is just with the classroom structure and environment. I think, you know, I've always been a fan of seminar style classes in which students are oftentimes leading the conversation. And sometimes that's not always possible depending on the size of the classroom and the composition of your students. But for me, it's really more about creating a specific kind of environment and going into it with a specific kind of mindset and philosophy than a particular piece of technology that I'm actually bringing into the classroom. One example that would just be online classrooms, online courses. This is something that has recently been tossed around at Tulane, where I do some teaching. There's an effort to start up a master's in bioethics program all online. It's all taught online, potentially with faculty across not only New Orleans, but the country. And I'm also involved in an online course right now. It's an online writing course. And the entire class is online, the lectures, the readings. And so, you know, one of the things that I wonder is just whether or not there's going to be just kind of the tension between the value of the personal encounter, having face-to-face encounters in person, and then just the value of being able to bring together people with similar interests from all over the country or the world. So I'm kind of fascinated to see how that plays out. And it kind of connects to what we were talking about earlier with just the proliferation of online media and sources within the poker world, whether it's Twitch streams or YouTube. There's just so many resources at hand, and we're seeing that filter into education as well. So it's just going to be interesting to see how it continues to take shape.
Thanks again to our guest, Ben Saxton. So, John, how did our interview with Ben impact your thinking about the work we're doing with Creative Next?
So one thing I took away from the conversation with Ben was just about how human and AI collaboration really is key for so many creative endeavors, including something like poker playing. And his description about just how the players, the human players, are evolving quickly because of the artificial intelligence, right? So you don't think about that element to it very much. And in fact, I'm perhaps that's true of other games where artificial intelligence is becoming important, say in chess or Go, where the players, the human players, are evolving. Their game is so much better. I think Ben gave some examples of, you know, the players of today versus the ones, you know, sort of at the beginning of this AI revolution in poker. I mean, so you have players now who even personally are better, and then you sort of have the whole cohort of players who are as a group so much better. It actually seems frightening is not the right word, but it just shows you sort of this continual evolution and advancement, and how AI as a tool, because it provides all these sort of scenarios for the players to play against, it's this really excellent training tool. So that point is something to think about as we think about human AI collaboration. We think about the AI getting better and better and how scary that might be. It's also worth thinking about how good the human beings are going to become at certain kinds of tasks as a result of practicing with AI.
Yeah, for me, Ben's insights made me realize how far away some practical solutions really are. Like, we have the event of Labradus defeating human poker pros, but we still don't have, a couple years later, we still don't have a on my phone poker engine that can do the most advanced things in real time, similar to what they have in chess, when we talked with Chris Chabris a couple of episodes ago. And so it's in chess, it took, a number of years. We're now 22 years after Deep Blue. It took, well over, 97. So, I dare say it took minimally 10 to 15 years before the technology shifted from supercomputer in a room to sort of democratically in everyone's hands who has a smartphone. There's time there. It's not that there's a giant achievement in technology in general, or in these cases, AI in particular, and then it immediately becomes something that's commercializable and available to everyone. There's lag, there's time. And so as we're hearing stories like the Labradus story in the news or other amazing feats of technology, yes, it's exciting. Yes, it's cool. But it's years, maybe decades before it's really going to help you and be something you're using as a tool on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, there's this disconnect, of course, between the technology that is sort of newsworthy, that's talked about, that's interesting, that sparks your imagination, and then the technology as adopted in your pocket, right? As in your car, in your home. And this gap is never really articulated because it takes so long for adoption to happen and for for the technology to permeate a large enough population where the costs for deploying it come down and it just becomes every day. So it's sort of sneaky that way. It creeps up on you, right? And I think that's something we want to avoid, right? We don't want just to wake up one day and find ourselves in a world that we just completely didn't plan for or anticipate. We have the opportunity to plan and to at least make a good faith effort to guide some of these technologies. But a lot of it flies under the radar, and a lot of it takes a really long time, as you pointed out.
Yeah. What did Ben say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
Yeah, so I'm going to go back to my earlier point just about, earlier I just talked about human and AI collaboration and how I thought that was such an important thing to consider with Creative Next. I would say that also, for me, was just a huge surprise that human beings could, so greatly improve over these short periods. I think Ben gave the example of Doug Polk, who said, the gap between the 2012 version of himself and the 2014 version of himself was this wide gap. So I'm thinking about, what if I had an AI piano teacher that you know, where say, here's the part of your playing that is suboptimal. Work here, you know, something like that, or an AI a producer or something. Here's the part of your mix that is really no good, John. You should focus here. Oh, okay, thanks. Thanks, AI. I'll go work on that. Like, what are the possibilities for creative professionals in whether a scientist or a mathematician or an engineer, if you had an AI sort of working in tandem with you? I'm repeating myself a little bit, but I think that's a wonderful point that Ben made.
Yeah. You know, that was similarly the big surprise for me was around that, but taking a little different direction. For me, sort of poker specifically, being that I was involved with the game, I saw some of the evolution over the years happen. You know, in 2002, the game, it was largely still an analog game. It wasn't a mainstream game. Certainly it was something that many people had casually played at one point or another in their personal lives, but it wasn't something that was like a major hobby for most people, and certainly not something people were playing online. And so the state of strategy was relatively unsophisticated. By 2007, after the poker boom, Chris Moneymaker, you know, winning the World Series, like Ben mentioned, by that point, the game was significantly more sophisticated because you had a lot of really smart people coming into poker who had backgrounds of intelligence and sort of analytical thought and problem solving. You know, you had financiers coming in, you had attorneys coming in, you had people from different walks of life who were very successful and smart in those areas shift into poker and try and make poker either, you know, casually a major hobby for themselves or even become professional and make it the primary focus of their work lives. And so by 2007, while the majority of the game was still what we might call sort of the old school thinking, you now had a group of players that were clearly better. You know, you had, I'll get a little into poker geekiness here, and I apologize for that, but you had your Tom Dwans, you had your Patrick Antoniuses, you know, you had your Phil Galfonds, who were just way ahead of the old school players. Now, by 2012, the game had really refined again, and that was because the people who were so far ahead in 2007, more and more people became like them. You know, instead of somebody like Dwan being the outlier, more and more people played in that way or learned from the way that he played to adapt and uplevel their game. Poker was also becoming increasingly global, particularly in China. And then, and so the game was really sophisticated then. Super smart people, good strategy. You could see it optimizing. And the things from just a decade before were, you know, the approaches, the type of players who were successful in that context were you know, nearing obsolete. And what surprised me was Ben saying, look, now in 7 years on, it's a whole new ball game and it's even moving faster. I was just kind of blown away with that because the quality of professional play around 2012, and I don't follow the pro scene at this point, so I'm checked out of it. To hear that it's improved that much in that short of a time is incredible. And, you know, part of it most recently might be due to AI, but part of it is also just due to, you know, maturity of the field, of how, you know, in 2002, it was really unsophisticated and just this little niche thing in the world to becoming this more mainstream thing that more and more people came into and helped to make more efficient, to make more optimal. The fact that just continues is remarkable. And, you know, I guess we're approaching peak with AI and with, you know, GTO and with Nash optimization. At some point that can't go any farther, I don't think. But I just found it, I was surprised and I found it interesting.
Yeah, that's totally fascinating.
Now, John, what did you learn from Ben that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
Ben talked a lot about sort of the game theory, optimal strategy, and exploitive strategies in poker, and talking about how you choose to approach your competitors, right? And these theories for how you can sort of best what the best outcomes will be and how you approach the game. And I started thinking about that a lot in terms of how we approach our sort of day-to-day interactions with other people and with, you know, just sort of generally speaking, how we approach life. So we all have our theories and strategies that we've accumulated over time, you know, based on how we were raised, based on our culture, based on the, you know, the environments we work and play in. And I think it's sort of key for us as a society to think about these culturally embedded strategies about how we're interacting with each other. And so in an abstract way, that's obviously, you know, how I'm treating people day to day. But in a much more concrete way, you know, we get back to the this idea of fairness, right? We talked about as a result of you know, the interview that we had with Toby around how AI gets formed. These ideas are intertwined, right? How our strategy is how we are approaching, you know, our lives, how we interact with other people, and sort of the overarching culture. A lot of these things are up for discussion and coming into play now. So I started thinking, am I, you know, choosing a game theory optimal strategy for my interactions with people? like what am I doing? Am I being exploitive, right? If someone were to analyze my interactions with the people in my life, what strategy would they take away? So I know that's a little eccentric, that's where this interview took me, and also just thinking about how we extrapolate these rules and manifest them in the AIs that we're building, right? How do we create fair interactions?
And I hope the game theory optimal and exploitative aren't the only two options for you.
Right. Yes. No. I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, you know, in terms of influencing my life, the point, and this relates a little bit to what we talked about before, but just the point that someone who was interested in becoming a pro 15 years ago realistically could, if they put in the time and they put in the effort, they could go from a casual player, someone who knew very little about the game, to being a pro who made a lot of money. That was a realistic journey. And fast forward to today and a world of poker engines and much more sophisticated strategy, much more saturated with highly intelligent people. And it's almost unrealistic. You know, it's almost, you know, becomes like, oh yeah, I'm going to be a movie star kind of thing, right? It's like, yeah, maybe, you know, some do, but it's much more likely that the outcome will be an unfortunate one for you if that's your expectation and hope for yourself. And you know, that sort of hit home for me in terms of how the whole world is changing around AI, around computation, and how more fields are getting more impenetrable. You know, if you think about science, for example, and science, you know, once upon a time, if we go back to like the time of Isaac Newton, I think that pretty much anybody could have gotten an interest in science and had some curiosity and poked around and done experiments and contributed, had some interesting discoveries. You know, that was all possible. Now today, in a world of theoretical physics, you would have to go to school for a really long time and be super smart, like in a way that wouldn't have been required in the 17th century in order to even participate in that. And, you know, when I was a little boy, my grandfather, who had an unrealistically inflated perception of me and my capabilities, he would always say to me, "Dirk, you can do whatever you want to do. You know, the cream always rises to the top. Anything you put your mind to, you're going to be able to do." And I've actually lived my life believing that. And in my life, I've pivoted a number of times. You know, I was in academia for a while, went into marketing, went into design, went into entrepreneurship, product, research, you know, journalism now, I think is to some degree what I think I'm doing, futurism. And I'm able to do that. But I, in the future, would I, you know, 20 years out, if I were living my own life, the same life, but, you know, I was starting, I was in my teens or 20s, 20 years from now, would I be able to do that? And I'm starting to think no. And that's weird. Like, that's strange. And I haven't, in talking to Ben, that sort of came into my mind for the first time. And I haven't yet wrapped my head around the implications of that. But I think it's true. I don't think I could have had so many different pivots and redesigned myself so frequently and so dramatically in some cases. And that's feels weird. And I need to kind of wrap my head around it. I think, you know, I mean, hopefully I'll live a while longer, but I've sort of lived my life, you know, I'm not going to keep pivoting into infinity. So the degree to which it actually impacts me is probably negligible, but you know, my children or just people who aren't even related to me, other people who I want to have good lives and you know, live the life that they're compelled to live, some of the opportunities to me may be getting closed off as a result of these technologies for future folks. And I'm just a little philosophical, a little sad about that.
Yeah, we'll have to dig into that some more because I have some thoughts on that, but we'll dig into that in a future episode for sure.
Sounds good. Each episode, we're going to finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, what interest or community that you are involved in has achieved rapid growth and sophistication over the last 15 or 20 years, and how is or could AI and big data further optimize it? Think about that for yourself, and feel free to tweet at us about it at GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at GoInvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most, healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at biff.is, that's biff.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter at GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish an article to extend and build upon each episode. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at dniemeyer, that's D-K-N-E-M-E-Y-E-R, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett, that's J-O-N-F-O-L-L-E-T-T. Our guest this episode is Ben Saxton. You can reach him on Twitter at B-T-Sax, that's B-E-E-T-E-E-S-A-X. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the hashtag CreativeNext. And of course, the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. Here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
As prices come down in cameras and projectors, imagine if every light bulb in our house was also could project onto a surface and also see interaction. So now virtually all surfaces become interactive. So you could be at your cutting board and cutting something and getting feedback around like, this slice of meat should be a little bit thinner or thicker or whatever. There's that sort of, again, you see these timeless ideas of feedback loops though, and interactivity and playfulness.